This is Practice in Place, Law and Justice Go Viral, a podcast that asks the question, how does a profession governed by precedent respond to the unprecedented? Practice in Place investigates how the practice of law and the administration of justice have adapted under the abrupt constraints of the COVID-19 era, how that has affected how and whether we achieve justice, and how those changes and that experience might or should change the practice, the profession, and its procedures forever. I'm Susie Solomon, clinical professor of law and director of the legal writing program at the University of Arizona's James E. Rogers College of Law. I'll be your host. Virtually any state court judge will tell you that one of the largest issues facing our civil justice system is the flood of unrepresented litigants. Unlike in criminal cases, in civil cases, there generally is no right to counsel. This means that the overwhelming majority of low-income individuals, and indeed most middle-income people too, face the grinding wheels of the civil justice system alone. By some estimates, two-thirds of civil litigants in the United States have no legal representation. In cases involving many of our most essential interests, housing, child welfare, the justice gap is a chasm. 98% of tenants in eviction cases are unrepresented, and 95% of those in child support matters. And the numbers only continue to grow. Civil legal aid organizations are overwhelmed, and some must turn away as many as two-thirds of those seeking their assistance. The harm is hardly insignificant. Data suggests that unrepresented litigants face significantly worse outcomes than represented ones. Stacy Butler has devoted a good part of her post-law school career to finding innovative and interdisciplinary ways to address that gap. She has quite a resume. She graduated summa cum laude from U Arizona Law, clerked for Ninth Circuit Judge William Canby, practiced at the Tucson firm of Deaconcini, McDonald, Yetwood, and Lacey, then spent 13 years as judicial clerk for Judge Jennifer Zipp at the U.S. District Court for the District of Arizona. She's president of the Board of Directors of Step Up to Justice, launched in 2017, which uses technology and innovative strategies to bring civil legal help more effectively to those who need it, striving to connect the largest possible number of people with quality legal services at the lowest possible cost. In 2018, Stacy mounted an attack on the civil justice gap from yet another angle, the Innovation for Justice Project, also known as I4J. I4J is one of a growing number of law school-based legal innovation labs, harnessing technology and interdisciplinary collaboration to design solutions to wicked problems. What's a wicked problem? Design theorists Horst Rittel and Melvin Weber introduced the term back in the early 1970s to capture the complexity of social policy problems that by their very nature aren't susceptible to an easy, quick fix. Stacy spoke with me about the Innovation for Justice Project and about Team I4J, the online workspace that brings together students, faculty, staff, alumni, and others willing to donate their time and expertise to tackle some of the issues that have come to head with the pressures and limitations imposed by the COVID-19 crisis. Tell me a little bit about what is Innovation for Justice? How did it get started? What does it do?
Sure. So the Innovation for Justice program is a social justice innovation lab that designs, builds, and tests disruptive solutions to the justice gap. It launched in the fall of 2018, and it runs projects using design and systems thinking as the framework. Those are both creative problem-solving approaches to tackle wicked problems that haven't been solved through conventional or traditional methods. All of the courses in the program are project-based and community-engaged. So since the program launched in the fall of 2018, we've had over 300 organizations and individuals involved in the program.
Wow. You say disruptive solutions. What do you mean by that?
So, yeah, we define disruption as change that adds value, that disrupts and improves. So, I define innovation as change that disrupts and improves. So when we talk about disruption, we're talking about doing something that is not the usual way that things are done, breaking with traditional methodologies or traditional approaches, and driving often change that happens very rapidly and in unexpected ways.
Tell me a little bit about some of the projects that the Innovation for Justice has tackled in the past.
So, you know, we've done a lot of different, we've worked in a lot of different areas. The first year we focused mostly on the issue of eviction because it's a pretty serious issue here in Tucson. Tucson is a top 10 evicting city nationally. We've also worked on domestic violence and debt collection, human trafficking. We're doing quite a bit of work with online dispute resolution and also with regulatory reform of the legal profession.
Talk to me a little bit about online dispute resolution. I mean, that sounds like something that's going to be very useful in the near term.
It is an interesting time to be running an online dispute resolution project. So our online dispute resolution project is in partnership with Pew Charitable Trusts and the Utah State Courts. And we are the first lab in the country to evaluate the usability of online dispute resolution. And so basically what that means is that we take Utah's existing online dispute resolution platform, which is being piloted now in three counties specifically for debt collection, and we take it out into the low-income community, and we have people navigate the tool from the smartphone in their hand. We record their usage. We have specific tasks we're looking to see if they can perform. We're timing how long it takes them to complete those tasks, how many critical errors they make, how satisfied they are with the process, and then doing some work with a tool called Adobe XD to redesign the platform, create new prototype versions that we think address deficiencies that we see in the baseline platform, and then take those back out to the community and test them. So the goal is to be iterative and to continue refining and redesigning until the tool really is usable for the people who need it. And in our case, you know, we're specifically interested in debt collection defendants who, you know, the debt collection is one of the highest volume types of cases in civil court. And so that population is, you know, it's a high number of self-represented litigants navigating the civil legal system without lawyers. So for an online tool to come along, which potentially puts the court in their hands, is very exciting in terms of potentially making court much more accessible than it would otherwise be, but it also carries a lot of risk that will take a system that traditionally excludes that population and just layer it onto a new platform. So we were actually in the middle of that project when COVID-19 hit. And so that's been a really interesting, there's been some very interesting revisions to the project in light of the fact that we can't send students out into the low-income community to work across a table with people. We had a lot of research done beforehand, but we're wrapping it up in several creative ways, and I think we're still on track to finish the project. But yeah, it has remarkable new relevance because, I mean, we're watching courts now go to, I think, what are just being called remote or virtual courts. You know, we see courts leaning pretty hard on telephonic and video conferencing. I think the next thing to come is that courts will realize that they have to have a more robust online infrastructure, partly to handle if a crisis like this happened again, to be better prepared for it. But also, I think we know that courts are incurring these deep backlogs now, particularly in those high volume cases like eviction and debt collection, and that if they can onboard an online dispute resolution tool, it may help clear that backlog, or at the very least, it may help them address new cases that are coming in while they're dealing with that backlog of cases that are being filed now. So it's a really good time to be able to roll out some information about how can we build that online dispute resolution tool in a way that is actually going to make the system usable for the people who really need it.
So it sounds like this has to be incredibly interdisciplinary. I know that most lawyers don't have the tech savvy, although some may, to do all of this. So who are the people that are bringing that technological expertise?
So everything that the Innovation for Justice program does is interdisciplinary, and historically, most of the projects are housed within courses, not all, but most, and the courses tend to be about half law students and then half graduate students from other disciplines. We also have an undergrad class, and we work really hard to diversify the the discipline backgrounds of the students in those courses. So, you know, the ODR class, I think, is a great example of that. There are three project leads. I'm the access to justice lens on the project, but Sarah Mauway is our UX expert, and we have a research assistant who isn't really an expert in Adobe XD. And so Sarah and that research assistant, Brian, are really able to teach and mentor the tech piece of the project. And then Chris Griffin, who was formerly at the Harvard Access to Justice Lab, is now a visiting professor here at U of A Law. He is really our empirical methods expert. And he's been able to work closely with the students on how do we collect data, how do we analyze data. So it's been really cool because we've watched students, we have 17 students from 9 different disciplines in that class. And it's been wonderful to watch students learn skill sets outside what they're studying in graduate school and also get to contribute their special knowledge. So, you know, the law students are uniquely positioned to be able to say, oh, the platform can't say that. That's not how we say it in law. And then for our design students to say that button can't go there. And for our students with some pretty crazy data skills to be able to crunch numbers and report out, and then for them to start cross-pollinating those skills. So I've got a team of law students now. You should see them in Adobe XD. It's amazing what they're designing and building and all the lingo they've learned. And so it's been really fun to watch them all work. They're a great team. All 17 of them have worked really beautifully together.
Great. So in response to the current situation, it sounds like disruptive change is something that everyone is looking for, whether they like it or not, because the disruption has already happened. How has innovation to justice innovation for justice sort of stepped into that space?
So yeah, I think everybody right now has something that they can contribute to the COVID-19 response. And I think what makes labs like ours, you know, we're one of 10 labs in the country. I think what makes us unique in terms of what we can contribute is that we do know how to creatively problem solve. And we had been saying before this crisis that the civil legal system is deeply broken, and that it's not a small fix, that we need a wholesale overhaul of the system if it's really going to work for the people who need it. And so we've already been exploring that space for a long time and what that change might need to look like. And it is things like online dispute resolution and helping people work collaboratively across disciplines. It's also starting to rethink what are legal services and who can provide them. And so I think that's another area that we'll see a lot of growth and expansion. And that, you know, relates to our regulatory reform work. But I think that's coming down the pipeline too, because there's now even more legal needs than ever. And, you know, we know how to frame out an innovation project and do the project management it takes to understand a problem from multiple perspectives, think creatively about solutions, test those solutions before you invest resources in them, being able to create feedback loops and community. All of those things are really important now when our traditional systems are failing and have failed, and everybody has been forced into this moment of rapid rebuilding.
Tell me a little bit about some of the specific projects that I4J is working on in right now. In this, about automating court forms and.
Oh, so you're talking about for Team I4J specifically? So yeah, so there's 10 projects right now in the Innovation for Justice program. One of those projects is a COVID-19 specific project, which is our Team I4J workspace. So what we were starting to see, first of all, was people coming together in various ways to try to organize, to be available. And it was clear that there were people in our network, students and alumni and faculty, that wanted to get involved and volunteer and felt that they had particularly legal skills to contribute, but other skills too. And then because we're an innovation lab, I was starting to hear from other organizations and courts locally and nationally who are really looking for innovation help. So the workspace is designed to bring those two groups together. So we have about 45 volunteers in the workspace, and I think seven or eight projects have come through so far. 3 closed out last week, so that was exciting. We had some really great early wins. So one of the projects was some research assistance for some organizations in Chicago that were trying to understand what was happening with debt collection filings there and whether they were still proceeding, and potentially becoming debt collection default judgments against people who maybe weren't receiving notice or hearings. And the students that volunteered on that project produced research that informed a larger effort that led to the governor of Illinois issuing an executive order that stays any garnishment of wages or bank accounts, particularly as stimulus funding is coming in. Those debt collection judgments can't be executed in terms of a garnishment against the debtor. So that was a really exciting early project. We're doing some work with the Self-Represented Litigation Network. They're trying to aggregate all of the power of attorney forms for every state in the country and have a clearinghouse where no matter where you are, you can go there and find it your form for your state, and make sure that you have those power of attorney forms, you know, in line and as a just in case, hopefully. And so we worked on finding what those three forms look like in Arizona and partnering with Arizona Supreme Court to get those three forms housed in one place on the court's website so that FCRLN can direct people to those. There's a wide array. We have quite a few eviction projects. Some students just produced a flyer. They worked with several organizations here and the constables here in Pima County to produce a flyer for tenants in English and Spanish that tells them what they need to know about COVID-19. And I think what I really loved about that particular project was, I think that other legal organizations were quick to produce, like, here's the form letter, here's the legal advice. But what we heard from the community was that tenants need like a holistic sense of how to be a tenant during COVID-19. So yes, they need to understand the impact of the executive order that stays evictions, but they also need to know, where do I go for emergency rental assistance? Where else can I get benefits or resources? What are the other things I need to know to protect myself during this time? Because it's not just, will I be evicted or not? It's really, how can I keep my house? And there's a lot of pieces to that besides just the letter that you give to your landlord. So it's that kind of work, and it's responsive to community need, and the volunteers have been pretty quick to pick things up and get them out the door. It's very scrappy, but it builds on technology that we are already using on a regular basis and processes that we're already using on a regular basis in the class. So, you know, it lives in Slack. A lot of stuff is with the Google Drive and the tools in the Google Drive. And so I had a team of students that already really knew how to lead a project using those tools. And so they've really stepped up and helped everybody integrate. So it's been great.
So the students are leading the projects with the interdisciplinary teams, or?
It's been a mix. Some of my leadership and legal innovation students have really played a leadership role in getting the workspace up and setting the process flows and the instructions and what people need to know to if they haven't used Slack before or some of the other tools that we use. And some of them have also taken leadership roles on getting projects launched and out the door, but also students that I've never met, that I've only communicated with through Slack or a Zoom call now, have also had just signed up. What I hear a lot is people who, they just want to do something, they want to feel useful, and they've been grateful to have a space where they can contribute.
So looking forward, one of my great hopes is that this COVID-19 crisis has just given, kind of lit a fire under the profession and under the system, and that some of these changes, will accelerate and become permanent and perhaps, move us more quickly, along that road towards better access to justice. What are your thoughts on that, and are you optimistic?
That's a good question. I do, in some ways, some of this is a little frustrating because I do think that there are those of us who have been saying for a long time that the system is really broken, and all this really did was shine a light on the failures. Yes, there are now a lot of new socioeconomic pressures on people that didn't have them before, but the reason that the system can't handle it is not new. And we could have been prepared before now. Better prepared to deal with something like this. So, I think what might change, gazing into my I4J crystal ball, I think what might change is that now our legislative and executive branches are seeing the failures more overtly than they cared to before, and have already engaged at the level of you know, executive orders that stay evictions, executive orders that stay wage garnishments, you know, things that have traditionally just been left to the courts and to the legal system. And so I think that kind of attention is good. I think it hopefully directs the public's attention to the failure of their legal profession and their judicial system. And that, you know, hopefully now the public will ask for a better system and for a profession that is not declaring a monopoly over a service they're not providing. And so, you know, we'll see what happens from all of this. But, you know, I do think it's been attention getting for the failures that we had.
It's just sort of startling to me that, for example, Pima County Superior Court. So, I mean, it's a urban area, well, you know, over a million people in the general area, doesn't have access to video hearings, doesn't have most of its forms online. I was reading one of the orders saying people have to come down and pick up a physical form, you know, to get an order of protection. And why is that not online? Do you think this will push courts to, push legislatures to give courts the resources and push courts to use the resources that way?
Yeah, I mean, that is a good point, because I think sometimes it is that courts just can't. They just are overtaxed and under-resourced, and they can't do all the things that, all the pressures that have been placed on them by these overwhelming numbers of self-represented litigants. That burden on the court is actually on us as a legal profession, that we've created a profession that is largely unaffordable to 86% of America. And so, you know, it is our fault that that litigants are trying to navigate the judicial system without lawyers. And also, courts are the last stop for these socioeconomic problems that courts have no control over. You know, if someone gets evicted because they don't have affordable housing and their wages are too low and they don't have capacity to save and endure a financial crisis. So, you know, it's not totally, so I'm glad that you frame it as, do courts need more resources to do more? Because yes, I think they do. You know, we also, the forms issue is sort of maddening in that, you know, we have all these different jurisdictions in Arizona and they all have their own way of doing things. And there has never been a successful effort to just create statewide forms that would work anywhere in Arizona. And so for that reason, it's very confusing, even when forms are online, and there are some sample forms at AZ Law Help and AZ Court Help, but it's hard to know which ones are for you and which jurisdiction you're in. And, you know, it's this Gordian knot that we've never been able to untangle. So, I hope that that will happen. I actually hope that we'll just also work to simplify the process and make courts more easy to navigate, whether it's online or in person, and using forms and instructions, or with the help of someone who, you know, has legal training but isn't a JD. I mean, there's so many approaches we could take to making the system more accessible. And I do think that the pressures that the COVID-19 crisis is putting on the system will drive some of that innovation.
Speaking of people without JDs delivering legal services, I know that I4J has been involved in some advocacy in that area. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's probably one of our more disruptive projects. But that is it's something that is being examined in various states across the country. Arizona is really at the forefront of this effort to re-regulate the profession and allow things like alternative business structures, non-lawyer ownership of legal service providers, people with specialized training but not a JD. I try not to use the phrase non-lawyers, able to provide services. We see that happening now in Washington and Utah, but it's been largely a market-driven model. So really what has happened is it has deputized paralegals who have boots on the ground experience and really know already a lot about how the system works and how the forms work. And now they are able to get additional training and licensure to still really operate within a law firm model mostly. My interest with the Access to Justice lens is that's, you know, the market model is a lovely way to potentially expand services from law firms, but that's not ever going to help low-income populations. And so where is the capacity to create people with legal training but not a JD who can serve that low-income population? And I think what we found is that there's a lot of potential collaboration and partnership there with social services. So we're working on right now the Licensed Legal Advocate pilot. I mean, it is the first project in the country to allow someone with legal training but not a JD to provide legal advice. So cracking the UPL ceiling and being able to provide legal advice, in this case, to survivors of domestic violence. It is a research project. We are building the curriculum and the training now. We have grant funding. It is approved by the Arizona Supreme Court. And so we will launch that in the fall and measure it for a year to see what are the deliverables and the outcomes when a new tier of legal professional exists for a population that would normally have no legal services at all. And what can they achieve? And it's a randomized controlled trial, so we'll be able to compare it to both a baseline and a group that exists kind of in parallel with the treatment group, and hopefully produce some results that can inform these decisions, both here in Arizona, but in other jurisdictions as well.
Do you think the confluence of the increased need for legal services and the difficulties that current law grads are going to find becoming licensed in this environment with bar exams being postponed or canceled, do you think that might accelerate some change, at least temporary change, that might become permanent?
I mean, I'm still holding out for the diploma privilege. Maybe that's overly optimistic, but for the sake of my graduates, I'm still hoping we get there in Arizona. I think, you know, we're talking about two different things. I think, you know, law grads, you know, whether they right now actually are, because our task force on legal service delivery expedited a rule change that allows our law grads to begin providing services as long as they're supervised by a lawyer, even if the bar exam doesn't happen or if we're postponing the bar exam or whatever happens. So that's really good news for our grads. You know, our grads will have a law license or work under the supervision of an attorney with a law license, and they will provide a level of service that JDs should be providing. I think that's a separate thing than you know, what other tiers of legal service providers might do in response to this crisis or ever. And I try to emphasize that with people who are worried about this idea of people with legal training but not a JD being out in the world giving legal advice, that first of all, it will continue to be regulated. It's not the Wild West of legal services, but that also the goal there is to reach populations that aren't being served by attorneys and probably don't need to be served by attorneys, you know, that keep attorneys operating at the top of their resume, and let's find new pathways to legal empowerment for people who can't afford attorneys.
Right. I mean, these aren't competing with attorneys. They're providing services that would not otherwise be provided and helping people who would otherwise be pro se.
Correct. Correct.
Well, thank you so much. And how, if people are interested in getting involved, whether law students or lawyers or others, how do they reach I4J and get involved, Team I4J?
So our I4J website, which is law.arizona.edu/I4J, that's our landing page. And on the left-hand side are tabs for our news and our projects and our curriculum. And one of those tabs will take you right to Team I4J. So if you go there, you can, as a community member, you can fill out an intake form and ask for help on a project. And if you're looking to volunteer, there's a instruction there to log into our Slack workspace and join us.
Maybe with the challenges and limitations of the COVID-19 crisis highlighting all the malfunctioning pieces of our civil justice system, we can start and continue a conversation about how to design, fund, implement, and sustain the kinds of changes that will make the promise of justice a reality for more Americans. As Stacy highlights, the courts may be where we're seeing the issues, but the roots of the problem run so much deeper and are intertwined in the crumbling infrastructure of a deeply broken system and a profession that's sometimes openly hostile to change. But initiatives like the Innovation for Justice Project show us that solutions are possible, and we need the collective will to make it happen. The talent is there, the technology is there, and maybe, just maybe, the time is now. Please look for future episodes of Practice in Place in the Arizona Law website at law.arizona.edu and wherever you listen to podcasts. We hope to continue providing a window into how the COVID-19 crisis has impacted our courts and the practice of law, and also sharing our insights
into what the response to the crisis tells us about the past, present, and future of our courts and of the legal profession. Until next time, thank you for listening.